The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Obviously, more broadly, we need a coherent strategy for how to deal with the hybrid approach of cyber and disinformation that is coming from our adversaries. But let me be clear about what I'm not saying. I am not advocating that the U.S. mimic the approach of Russia and China, the idea that states have a sovereign right to control or censor information within their borders. Frankly, that is a vision that's incompatible with American values and our Constitution. What I am saying, though, is that we need to confront the fact that our adversaries have an approach that considers control of information an essential component of their overall defensive and offensive strategies. We have not only failed to recognize this situation over the last two decades, but we've particularly tended to downplay and minimize the dangers of information operations.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 15th, 2018. Last week, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia addressed a crowd at the Center for New American Security, offering what he called a new cyber doctrine for cyber warfare and information operations. Senator Warner currently serves as the vice chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. In that role, he helps to oversee that committee's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. To combat the sort of information warfare and cyber attacks used in that election, as well as the more general and staggering cybersecurity threat posed to U.S. persons and entities, the senator lays out a series of detailed recommendations for this doctrine, emphasizing establishing international cyber norms and rules, combating disinformation and misinformation, hardening networks, weapon systems, and Internet of Things devices, realigning defense spending, and strong federal leadership. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 374, Senator Mark Warner on a new cyber doctrine.
This really is, I share with what Victoria said, I think one of the most urgent challenges of our time. The use of cyber warfare by our adversaries and the need for us in the United States to articulate a clear and thoughtful U.S. cyber doctrine. Now, a little unusual that we're doing this today on December 7th, which is obviously an auspicious date in our history. We remember Pearl Harbor as the first foreign attack on U.S. soil in modern history. Unfortunately, we also remember Pearl Harbor as a major intelligence failure. As vice chairman of the Intelligence Committee, I've spent the better part of the last 2 years on an investigation connected to America's most recent intelligence failure, which was also a failure of imagination, a failure to identify Russia's broader strategy to interfere in our elections. Our federal government and institutions were caught flat-footed in 2016, and our social media companies failed to anticipate how their platforms could be manipulated and misused by Russian operatives. Frankly, we should have seen it coming. Over the last two decades, adversary nations, like Russia, have developed a radically different conception of information security, one that spans cyber warfare and information operations. I fear that we've entered a new era of nation-state conflict, one in which a nation projects strength less through traditional military hardware and more through cyber and information warfare. For the better part of two decades, this was a domain where we thought in the United States we had unparalleled superiority. The thinking was our cyber capabilities were unmatched. Our supposed superiority allowed us to write the rules. This confidence appears to have blinded us on three important developments. First, we are under attack, and candidly, we have been under attack for many years. Our adversaries and their proxies are carrying out cyber attacks at every level of our society. We've seen state-sponsored or sanctioned attacks on our healthcare systems, energy infrastructure, and our financial system. We are witnessing constant intrusions into our federal networks. We are seeing regular attempts to access parts of our critical infrastructure and hold them ransom. Last year, we saw global ransomware attacks increase by 93%. Denial of service attacks increased by 91%. According to some estimates, cyber attacks and cybercrime account for up to $175 billion in economic and intellectual property loss in North America alone. Globally, the estimates are closer to $600 billion. And typically, our adversaries aren't even using their most sophisticated cyber tools. They are attacking opportunistically, using phishing techniques, and figuratively rattling unlocked doors. This has all been happening under our noses. The effects have been devastating, yet the attackers have faced few, if any, consequences. Second, in many ways, we brought this on ourselves. We live in a society that is becoming more and more dependent on products and networks that are under constant attack. Yet the level of security we accept in commercial technology products is unacceptably low, particularly when it comes to the growing Internet of Things. The problem is only compounded by our society-wide failure to promote appropriate cyber hygiene. It's an outrage that more digital services, from email to online banking, don't come up with default two-factor authentication. And it's totally unacceptable that large enterprises, including federal agencies, aren't using the available tools of defense. Lastly, we have failed to recognize that our adversaries are working from a totally different playbook. Countries like Russia are increasingly merging traditional cyber attacks with information operations. This emerging brand of hybrid cyber warfare exploits our greatest strengths, our openness, and free flow of ideas. And unfortunately, we're just now waking up to that fact. Looking back, the signs have been pretty obvious. 20 years ago, Sergei Lavrov, then serving as Russia's UN ambassador, advanced a draft resolution at the United Nations dealing with cyber and, quote, prohibiting particular dangerous flows, forms of information operations. Now, we can debate the sincerity of Russia's draft resolution, but in hindsight, the premise of this resolution is striking. Specifically, the Russians saw traditional cyber warfare and cyber espionage interlinked with information operations. It's true that as recently as 2016, in the Russia operations against our system there, the cyber operations, the hacking of the DNC and the Podesta emails, was carried out with one vector, and the misinformation and IRA activities were on a separate tracks. But there's no doubt that Putin and his leaderships now sees the full potential of marrying these cyber operations. By contrast, our country spent two decades treating information operations and traditional information security as distinct domains. And increasingly, we treated info operations as quaint and, frankly, outmoded. Just a year after Lavrov introduced the resolution, the United States eliminated the United States Information Agency, relegating counter-propaganda and information operations to a lower tier of foreign policy. In the two decades that followed, the U.S. embraced the Internet resolution as inherently democratizing, but we ignored the warning signs outside the bubble of Western democracies. The naivete of U.S. policymakers extended not just to Russia, but to China as well. Recall when President Clinton warned China that attempts to police the Internet would be, quote, like nailing Jell-O to the wall. In fact, China instead has been wildly successful at harnessing the economic benefits of the Internet in the absence of political freedom. China's doctrine of cyber sovereignty is the idea that a state has the absolute right to control information within its border. This takes the form of censorship, disinformation, and social control. It also takes the form of traditional computer network exploitation. And China has developed a powerful cyber and information affairs bureaucracy with broad authority to enforce their doctrine. We see indications of the Chinese approach in their successful efforts to recruit Western companies to their information control efforts. It's pretty amazing to me that Google is actually looking to work with China to develop a censored version of its search engine in China. Today, China's cyber and censorship infrastructure is the envy of authoritarian regimes around the world. China is now exploiting both its technology and its cyber sovereignty doctrine to countries like Venezuela, Ethiopia, and Pakistan. With the export of these tools and ideas, and with countries like North Korea and Iran copying Russia's disinformation playbook, these challenges will only get worse. And yet, as a nation, we basically remain complacent. Now, despite a flurry of strategy documents from the White House and DOD, the federal government is still not sufficiently organized or resourced to tackle this hybrid threat. We have no White House cyber czar, no cyber bureau, or senior cyber coordinator at the State Department. And we still have insufficient capacity at both state and DHS when it comes to both cybersecurity and disinformation. Our Global Engagement Center at the State Department is not sufficiently equipped to counter propaganda from our adversaries. And the White House has still not clarified the roles and responsibilities for cyber across the whole expanse of USG. While some in the private sector have begun to grapple with these challenges, many more remain resistant to changes and regulations needed. And the American people are still not fully aware and cognizant of the threat. And they have not internalized the lessons of the last few years. We have a long way to go on cyber hygiene and online media consumption habits. Let me be clear. Congress as well does not have its act together. We have no cyber committee. Cyber cuts across numerous committee jurisdictions, frequently hindering our ability to get ahead of the problem. And it's even worse in the area of misinformation and disinformation. And the dangers are only growing as new technologies such as deep fakes, where audio and video manipulation can literally put words in the mouth of an elected official, a business leader, or any other leader, and these efforts are now being commercialized. The truth is, we all know as a nation, we are becoming ever more dependent on software. But at the same time, we are treating cybersecurity, network resiliency, and data reliability as afterthoughts. And these vulnerabilities will only continue to grow as our so-called real economy becomes increasingly inseparable from our digital economy. If we're going to turn this around, we need not just a whole of government approach, but we need a whole of society cyber doctrine. So what would a U.S. cyber doctrine look like? It's not enough to simply improve the security of our infrastructure, computer systems, and data. We must also deal with adversaries who are using American technologies to exploit our freedom, our openness, and basically attack our most important asset, our democracy. So let me modestly lay out five recommendations. First, we need to develop new rules and norms for the use of cyber and information operations. And we need to better enforce existing norms. And most importantly, we cannot do this alone. We need to do this on an international scale. We need to develop shared strategies with our allies that will strengthen these norms. And when possible, we need to get our adversaries to buy into these norms as well. The truth is, our adversaries continue to believe that there won't be consequences for their actions. Now, we all know in the post-9/11 national security environment, we spent tremendous energy combating terrorism and rogue states, and that was appropriate. But frankly, we've allowed some of our near-peer adversaries to operate with relative immunity when they attacked the United States in the digital domain. There have been some reports in the press about United States supposedly pushing back at second-tier adversaries on occasion, and some of these items we all know about. But we've, frankly, largely avoided this with Russia and China out of a fear of a cyber escalation. I think we all would recognize if through cyber tools somehow Moscow got shut down for 24 hours, it would be a problem. But if someone shut down New York for 24 hours, it would be a global crisis. And as a result, for China and Russia, it's pretty much been open season in terms of their attacks against the United States. This has to come to a conclusion. We need a national conversation about defensive and offensive tools we are willing to use to respond to the ongoing threats we face. In short, we need to start holding our adversaries accountable. Failing to articulate a clear set of expectations about when and where we will respond to cyber attacks is not just bad policy, it's downright dangerous. We are allowing other nations to write the playbook on cyber norms. Part of this is a result of U.S. inaction. From the late 90s into the early 2000s, the U.S. was a consistent dissenting voice at the UN where meetings on cyber norms were proposed. In part, this reflected our aversion to piecemeal approaches to cybersecurity, but it also reflected a view that we didn't want, as America, to be bound by lesser nations. In 2015, there was a major effort at the UN, including the United States in this case, to agree to principles of state behavior in cyberspace. We saw some international consensus around protecting critical infrastructure and investigating and mitigating cybercrime. Unfortunately, these 2015 principles at the UN failed to address economic espionage. And even the short-lived 2015 U.S.-China cyber espionage deal was insufficient. And in 2017, disagreements between the U.S., China, and Russia led to a deadlock on the question of how international law should apply to cyber conflicts. And let's acknowledge, since that time, little progress has been made. Now, it's been true that some folks in the private sector and the NGO space have stepped up. Look at Microsoft's Digital Geneva Convention. Look at the recent Paris call for trust and cybersecurity, trust and security in cyberspace that was signed by 57 nations, but not the United States. This is another example of the United States stepping back on the world stage and allowing countries like France to fill the void. Recently, the U.S. government and the State Department in particular have renewed efforts to advance norms and norms discussion. The efforts must be elevated and strengthened. But norms on traditional cyber attacks alone are not enough. We also need to bring information operations into the debate. This includes building support for rules that address the Internet's potential for censorship and repression. We need to present alternatives that explicitly embrace a free and open Internet. And we need that responsibility to extend not only to government, but to the private sector as well. We need multilateral agreements with key allies, just like we've done with international treaties on biological and chemical weapons. That discussion needs to address mutual defense commitments. We should be linking consensus principles of state behavior in cyberspace explicitly with deterrence and enforcement doctrines. U.S. policymakers with allies should predetermine responses for potential targets, perpetrators, and severity of attack. That means clearly and publicly linking actions and countermeasures to specific provocations. That could mean sanctions, export controls, or indictments. It could even include military action or other responses. Now we should be realistic, though, about the limits of norms in shaping behavior. Let's not kid ourselves. At least in the short run, nations like Russia that routinely ignore global norms is not going to make an about-face in the cyber domain. But this should not deter us. It should give us a more realistic set of expectations for how quickly we can expect to see results. But the stronger we make the alliances, the more teeth we can apply to these norms, the more countries we can recruit to them, the more effective the efforts will be at disciplining the behaviors of Russia, China, and other similar adversaries. My second recommendation is we need a society-wide effort to combat misinformation and disinformation, particularly on social media. My eyes were open to this through the Intel Committee's investigation on the Russian incursion. Everyone on the committee, Democrat and Republican alike, agrees that the linkage between cyber threats and disinformation is a serious challenge, especially on social media. And again, in some ways, this misuse and abuse of social media was a whole new world for the Intel community. It's now clear that foreign agents used American-made social media to spread misinformation and hijack our civil discourse. Again, let's quickly recap. The Russian playbook in 2016 included cyber penetrations of our election infrastructure, hacks and weaponizing of leaked information, amplification of divisive pro-Kremlin messages via social media, traditional overt propaganda, funding and supporting extreme candidates or parties, and misinformation, disinformation, and the real thing in terms of fake news. The goal was and is to undermine our faith in facts, our faith in the news media, and our faith in the democratic process. The truth is, none of this ended in 2016. This is an ongoing threat, and not just to the United States. We've also seen these tools used against all Western democracies. We've seen them used to incite racial and ethnic violence in countries like Myanmar. This threat is particularly serious in countries with low media literacy. In many ways, in those countries, social media is the internet. So what do we do? How do we combat this threat? We can start by recognizing that this is truly a global problem. A 21st century cyber and misinformation doctrine should lean more into our alliances like NATO and other allies who share our values. Earlier this year, Senator Rubio and I brought together a group of 12 parliamentarians from across our NATO allies, and every one of our NATO countries have indicated they have seen evidence of Russian intervention within either their election process or within their civil society. We got these 12 parliamentarians together at the Atlantic Council. We focused this meeting on combating Russian election interference. Now, the irony of the meeting date was that was the very same day that President Trump appeared on the international stage with President Putin, and we saw an American president kowtowing to a Russian leader. Meanwhile, we were working with our NATO allies to develop a roadmap for increased cooperation and information sharing to counter Russian cyber and misinformation, disinformation aggression. In many countries, the truth is, because they've experienced this for a longer period of time, these countries are further along in educating their populations about the threat of misinformation and disinformation. Last month, I met with the Prime Minister of Finland. As he put it, The Finns have been dealing with Russian disinformation and misinformation for well over 100 years. But Finland is one of the most resilient countries when it comes to countering this threat from its neighbor to the east. I asked why. Again, I believe it's partially because of their whole-of-society approach. It relies on a free press that maintains trust through strong self-regulatory mechanisms and high journalistic standards. It places a limit on the use of social media platforms, particularly for the very young. They also have a vibrant digital civics initiative, something that we desperately lack. Finland's approach also depends on a national leadership that stays true to its values, even in the midst of contested elections and its own brand of partisan politics. Here in the United States, it will take all of us, the private sector, the government, including us in Congress, as well as the American people, to deal with this new and evolving threat. In terms of the private sector, the major platform companies like Twitter and Facebook, but also Reddit, YouTube, Tumblr, aren't doing nearly enough to prevent their platforms from becoming petri dishes for Russian disinformation and propaganda. I don't have an interest, let me be clear, in regulating these companies into oblivion or stopping innovation. But as these companies have grown from dorm room startups to huge media companies of the 21st century, they have to acknowledge with that great power comes greater responsibility. I recall very vividly that immediately following the 2016 election, when I started to raise the question that we might have had Russian interference, Mr. Zuckerberg publicly ridiculed the idea that Russia had influenced the U.S. elections via a Facebook post that he basically said the idea that Russia intervened was, quote, a pretty crazy idea. Now, I don't pretend to have all the solutions, but I expect these platforms to work with Congress so that together we can take steps to protect the integrity of our elections and civil discourse in the future. Now, companies like Facebook and Twitter have taken some helpful voluntary steps, but we need to see much more from them and their peers. That's going to require investments in people and technology to help identify misinformation before it spreads widely. Now, I put forward a white paper with 20 ideas that lays out some of the policy proposals for addressing this. For example, I think we could all agree we need to start with greater transparency. I think human beings ought to have a right to know when they're being contacted on social media, whether that message is actually coming from a fellow human being or from a bot. There's nothing inherently wrong with machine-generated information coming to us, but we ought to have that knowledge. I've also put forward bipartisan legislation, the so-called Honest Ads Act, that would require greater transparency and disclosure for online political advertising. I also believe we need a full-fledged debate on the fact that companies should have a duty to identify and ferret out inauthentic accounts. If someone says they're Mark posting from Alexandria, but it's actually Boris from St. Petersburg, we at least ought to have a geo-indicator when that post appears. We've also put forward some detailed ideas around how we look at platforms' responsibility, and I would acknowledge that Facebook acknowledged this responsibility to try to take down truly defamatory content. I think platforms also should give greater access to independent academics and other analysts studying social trends like disinformation. In our paper, we also put forward a number of other ideas around privacy, price transparency, data portability. Just the basic idea that if any American knew how much data was being collected, that would help increase our knowledge. The truth is, most Americans think these services are free. There is nothing free about the amount of information these companies collect about each of us and then use in the marketplace. Now, these ideas are intended to spark a discussion, and we desperately need social media companies' input. But we have to move quickly. And at some point, if they don't work with us, Congress will have to act on its own. One thing is clear. The wild, wild west days of social media are coming to an end. Third, we need to harden the security of our computer networks, weapon systems, and IoT devices. many of the responsibilities for cyber and misinformation and disinformation will fall on the government. But our nation's strategic response must also include greater vigilance by the private sector, which, to tell the truth, has frequently resisted efforts to improve the security of their products. For over a decade, the United States thought it could set a light-touch standard for global data protection by basically avoiding legislation. And while, let me be the first, as a former business guy, I understand regulations can have costs. But what we've also learned in our country is that inaction can also cause costs, as other jurisdictions leap ahead of us with more stringent privacy and data protections. We see this with the GDPR, where the U.S.'s failure to adopt national reasonable data protection and privacy rules left the field open for candidly clunkier European rules. And these standards that were set by Europe are now being adopted by major economies like Brazil, India, and Kenya. More broadly, we need to think about a software liability regime that drives the market towards more secure development across the entire product lifecycle. But nowhere is the need for private responsibility greater than in the Internet of Things. General Ashley, director of the DIA, has described insecure IoT and mobile devices as, quote, the most emerging cyber threat to our national security. So, as a first step, we should use the purchasing power of the federal government to require that IoT devices meet at least minimum security standards. And again, I have bipartisan legislation on this with Senator Cory Gardner. At least at the federal level, with federal dollars, we need to make sure that the devices we purchase are patchable, need to make sure that they don't have hard-coded passwords that cannot be changed, and we must make sure they meet standards that they're free of known security vulnerabilities. On a broader level, beyond IoT, public companies should have at least one board member who understands and can model cyber risk. Another area I've been working on is trying to impose at least some level of financial penalties on companies like Equifax, who failed repeatedly to take the necessary steps to secure their systems from cyber intrusions. Unfortunately, even in areas where we could expect a higher level of security and cyber hygiene, we find some of these same problems. In October, a GAO report found that, quote, nearly all of our new weapon systems under development are vulnerable to cyber attack. Now, earlier this year, we successfully included language in the NDAA requiring cyber vulnerability assessments for weapon systems, which hopefully will help correct this problem. And the Pentagon has recently taken steps to make cybersecurity a greater priority within the DoD. But frankly, we face serious workforce challenges as well in recruiting and retaining top cyber professionals in the government when they have such attractive offers in the private sector. Now, this is a good segue to my fourth recommendation, realigning some of our defense spending priorities. The United States military budget, and I'm proud to say I'm as pro-defense as anyone, recently was passed at $716 billion. The remarkable thing is, when we look at Russia, its budget, military-wise, is about $70 billion. The truth is, the United States is spending most of its money on conventional weapons and personnel. By contrast, Russia devotes a much greater portion of that much smaller budget to cyber and other tools of asymmetric warfare like misinformation. Russia has come to the realization, and some of this goes back to 2011, when the then chairman of the Russian equivalent of the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff laid out the Russian military doctrine for the 21st century, where they said Russia could not compete with the West in terms of tanks and trucks and ships and guns, but in the realm of cyber or misinformation or disinformation, they could compete. And the truth is, when it comes to cyber, misinformation, and disinformation, Russia is already our peer, and in the areas of misinformation and disinformation, I believe, is ahead of us. Truth is, if you look back at Russia's effectiveness and cost effectiveness, if you add up all that Russia spent interfering in our elections in 2016, all they spent in the French elections in 2017, and then add on their cost of spending in the Brexit election, and then add it all together, it's less than the cost of one new F-35 airplane. So the notion that this is a one-off example isn't the case. This is both an effective methodology for Russia, and it's also remarkably cheap. The same is true with China. China spends more on its defense budget, and some of that's opaque. But estimates are that it spends around $200 billion. Again, spending a disproportionate amount on cyber and misinformation and disinformation. And the frightening thing to me is the delta between what we spend on our defense budget and China spends, that $500 billion. China is investing in artificial intelligence, quantum computing, 5G technology, and a whole host of other technologies in the 21st century technologies where China hopes not to simply be our peer, but to actually lead the world. Frankly, they are starting to outpace us in these investments by an orders of magnitude. We need to realign our priorities while we still can. We need to redirect some of our DOD spending towards cyber and, frankly, within other parts of our government, misinformation and disinformation. And at the same time, we need that Sputnik moment to make sure that we make the investments in 5G, AI, quantum, and other technologies to keep a pace of particularly China. The final point is that we desperately need strong federal and presidential leadership for any U.S. digital doctrine to be truly effective. Because this challenge literally touches every aspect of our society, we need presidential leadership and a senior coordinating official to head the interagency process on this issue. It's true there are men and women within DOD and DHS and within other agencies working really hard to try to protect the United States from cyber attacks. And we made some good progress in 2018 in terms of election security. But only the president can mobilize the whole of society strategy we need. Now, I do want to acknowledge some positive steps, even by this administration, have been taken in recent months. The White House and DOD have released two important strategic documents on cyber strategy that move us in the right direction. I also welcome the delegation of authorities to defend and deter cyber attacks below the presidential level. This will allow for quicker responses and greater interagency coordination. But again, these actions alone are inadequate. In the most recent NDAA, Congress attempted to establish a more aggressive posture on U.S. cybersecurity policy. This includes the potential use of offensive cyber capabilities to deter and respond to cyber attacks against U.S. interests, as well as authorization to combat info operations. It also grants the President and Defense Secretary authority to direct Cyber Command to respond and deter to, quote, an active and systematic and ongoing campaign attacks carried out by countries like Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. These powers, if used correctly, are important components of a cyber doctrine, but by definition, they require decisive and thoughtful leadership at the top. I'll leave you with a couple of final thoughts. Obviously, more broadly, we need a coherent strategy for how to deal with the hybrid approach of cyber and disinformation that is coming from our adversaries. But let me be clear about what I'm not saying. I am not advocating that the U.S. mimic the approach of Russia and China, the idea that states have a sovereign right to control or censor information within their borders. Frankly, that is a vision that's incompatible with American values and our Constitution. What I am saying, though, is that we need to confront the fact that our adversaries have an approach that considers control of information an essential component of their overall defensive and offensive strategies. We have not only failed to recognize this situation over the last two decades, but we've particularly tended to downplay and minimize the dangers of information operations. The truth is, the 2016 presidential campaign served as a wake-up call for cyber attacks and information operations. Now, people keep warning, and today being December 7th, of a digital Pearl Harbor or a digital 9/11, as if there will be a single act that will wake the country and make us take action on these issues. But I think I know, and I think many of you in this room know as well, we're already living those events on a daily basis. Look, simply look at the 2017 NotPetya attack. In the United States, we treated that as a one-day news story that was way below the fold. The truth is, the cost of that one single attack was more than $10 billion. This is the most costly and devastating cybersecurity attack in modern history, but most Americans have no idea that it even occurred. The true cost of our cyber vulnerabilities and the true cost of those attacks won't come with a single event. They will be gradual and accumulating. Our personal, corporate, and government data is being bled from every network every day. Our faith in our institutions and our tolerance for one another is being eroded by misinformation. This is leaving us exposed as individuals and vulnerable as a country. It's time that we dramatically shift how we view these threats. I hope the ideas that I've laid out today will help move us towards the comprehensive cyber doctrine and misinformation, disinformation doctrine that we so desperately need in these challenging times. Thank you very much.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the Center for New American Security and the Office of Senator Mark Warner for providing this audio. If you haven't yet, please take a moment to share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a rating and 5-star review wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. This podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.